Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. We have a very special guest today with our show, a man who has decided that he wanted to put out into print a story about his dealing with cancer. Cancer is something that can create not only a dramatic change in your life, but in this instance, he talks about how not only did it create a change in his life, but it changed his life in very special ways. And his book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, goes a long way to share what he has come to learn from his experiences of dealing with this unbelievable disease. David Koop, welcome to the show.
Donna, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and talk with you and your listeners today. Opportunity to share my message that I've been so lucky to have an opportunity to share. You know, when I was first diagnosed with cancer, it's called osteosarcoma, a form of bone cancer that's growing on my spine. They said, get your affairs in order, Dave, because you're going to be dead before the end of the year. There's not really anything we can do for you. And that's a pretty stark statement to get from not one but three different doctors.
Yes, and, it is. David, I have to say, I've interviewed a lot of people through the years, thousands, and when I have had material come across my desk, frequently it's written by women. It seems as if men do not want, often, not all, you're obviously not included in the group, they don't want to talk about what they're going through. And I think that this many times is very sad. Women have a patterning of sharing, and this is just a part of us. We will have our friends, we talk about what we're going through, but men have been indoctrinated so much to not talk about what they're going through. It's not macho. It's not, gee whiz, I'm a man. I've got to just hang in there and not even hang in there. I can be a bear, but nobody is supposed to know that you are going through what you're going through. And when I finished reading your book, I thought to myself, this took real guts for you to write this. Now, you might disagree with me, but I think to have this kind of candor about what you went through, about what your life was like before, which, by the way, for you, those of you listening, David is an entrepreneur. He was an entrepreneur when it came to the prepaid legal business. He became nationally known for this. And by the way, he didn't even have a college degree. But he became very known for this. He's done all kinds of companies, everything from Christmas trees, third-party administration, manufacturing, viticulture, reforestation. I mean, and David has been on all kinds of shows. So people, when they would hear about your life, they would say, oh, everything's hunky-dory. My goodness, you just had all kinds of wonderful things that were in your life, which they were. But you also, in your book, you talk about your first wife, your wonderful son, Christopher. You talk about how your first wife, after she had your son, told you out and out, she was going to divorce you, take the kid, take all your money. It's like something out of Dallas. And just go off. And your life had all kinds of paradigms to it. But when you were diagnosed with this cancer, little did you know that it was going to have such an impact on your life. And what I found so interesting is that you were dating. You decided you wanted to date. And when you had gotten the information that you would have cancer, one woman you were going to date, she walked out. She just wouldn't have anything to do with you. This was quite an aha period, wasn't it?
Yeah, she had actually been pressuring to get married. We were not just dating. It was a very serious relationship, and I was giving serious consideration to getting married. And I came home from the doctor and sat down on the couch and said, "Honey, I've got something I have to share with you." And I told her, and she cried, and we hugged, and she said, "You know, I have to go to the restroom. I'll be right back." And she literally got up, walked out the door without saying goodbye, and I never saw her again. She wouldn't answer mm-hmm. my phone calls, wouldn't return emails. And I guess the best thing is I found out before I married her what kind of a person she was.
Yes, that was a very good thing. Now, I loved the portion of the book where your wife, Carrie, wrote. And it is something you said in your book. You said, after helping to edit the book time and time again, Carrie decided she wanted to tell a part of your story, but in her words. And I had to chuckle because her first sentence was, in early 2009, I guess the universe had decided it had thrown enough crud at me. She had been through a divorce and breast cancer herself in 2008. Yeah. And she was waiting for something decent to come her way. And you came into her life. And she said she didn't think that could ever happen.
No, I don't think either one of us expected. Well, I know for a fact, you know, like everybody else in life, I've had good relationships and I've had bad relationships. Mm-hmm. But until I met Carrie, I had no idea what a true partner was actually like. And it is different from anything I've ever experienced before. And I am truly a very, very lucky man.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think both of you are fortunate to be with each other because both of you had gone through some things. And with her having gone through the cancer herself, she had an awareness. She could never have imagined the depths that she were going to go through, but she had an awareness of what it was like to be in that environment, to deal with the medical diagnoses, the various applications. Now, you were not supposed to live, period. By all rights and appearances and diagnoses, you shouldn't even be here today, but you are.
I'm an honorary fella.
Yes, you are. And you're 6'3", and before this all really hit you, you weighed 300 pounds, which means you were no small peanut here. You had this wonderful boy, Christopher, and I love the story in here, in your book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, about how when your son was born and how he really didn't want to be born.
Mm-hmm.
Your wife had to, at that time, had to have a C-section because it just was creating all kinds of problems. This was one kid that said, "I'm going to come out when I want to come out." And he came out, and by golly, he was screaming and causing all kinds of commotions. And you talked to him, and he cried again. He looked you right in the eye.
That was a very, very moving moment for me. It's still, as a matter of fact, Donna, it's giving me goosebumps right now just thinking about it. He was wailing away. You know, when they got him out through the C-section, they whisked him away because of the fact that he was crashing. His pediatrician was there, and a couple neonatal nurses were there. They took him away to the other side of the operating room to do the Apgar score. And he was just wailing and wailing and wailing. And finally, the doctor looked at me, the pediatrician. He said, "Would you like to meet your son?" And I went over and I said, "Hello, Christopher." And he went immediately quiet, rocked his head over, and stared me right in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been singing him songs and telling him story while he was in the womb because they said they can hear you. And I didn't know if it was true or not, but, you know, I wanted to give it a try. But that proved to me, out of all the voices in that room, when he heard me, he just came completely content and still rolled his head over and just fixed his eyes right on me. It was amazing.
You share so many of these personal experiences in the first part of your book, I'd say the first half of your book, and you have some very powerful quotes that are interspersed through the book prior to chapters where you're sharing concepts. One of them was a quote by Joseph Campbell: "We must be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us. The old skin has to be shed before the new one can come. Little did you know that that's exactly what you were going through. You were shedding more than you could have ever imagined, but who would have put in the programming the kind of experiences that you went through? This was phenomenal. Now, let's talk a little bit, because there are so many people that could be listening that may have loved ones or have friends that are going through a situation where they might have cancer. I can think of two people right now, right off the top of my head, that I know of, and I've met a number of others. It just seems like the big C looms in the environment of lives for so many people. And the information that you give in your book about your experience, I think, speaks volumes. And I really am appreciative that you as a man have been, again, as candid as you've been in this book. Now, you were told to get your affairs in order. What did you do?
Well, like I said, I'm an honorary fellow, and I don't try to let somebody else steer my life. But just on the off chance that they were correct, I did. I liquidated all of my businesses. I sold all of my real estate. All of my investment stocks, bonds, I converted straight to cash. And it's another way that I was very, very lucky in my life, because all of this happened in 2006, just before the stock market crashed, just before the real estate crash. And so I was protected from all of that by this event. But, you know, the title of the book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I've Got It, there's a half a dozen reasons in the book why it's a good thing, and you've read that. But the main one I want to share with your listeners, when you get the kind of cancer I have, osteosarcoma, this bone cancer on my spine, the first thing they do is a full-body bone scan and a full-body tissue scan to see if it has metastasized anywhere else. And when they did that, they found a massive pulmonary embolism just waiting to break loose. So they raced me into the emergency room, and they put this metal cage in the vena cava, a little wire contraption, looks like an umbrella with no fabric on it. And 9 days later, that embolism broke loose, and the filter caught it. Now, if I hadn't had the cancer, I would have never known about that embolism. I would have just fallen over dead. That's the pulmonary embolism. That's one where you turn to your wife to say, honey, I don't feel, and you don't ever get to finish the sentence. You just fall over dead. Mm-hmm. So had I not had cancer, I wouldn't even be here today. So it really is a very good thing I got cancer.
When you settled everything and you find out about this embolism and you go through the experience now, you said it was called a chordoma, C-H-O-R-D-O-M-A, and you said it's a particularly nasty form of cancer.
Well, for the first 9 months, all of the diagnoses said it was chordoma, which is very ugly. One of the things that I learned, and I will share with your listeners, Donna, is when a doctor gives you an ugly diagnosis like that, please do not go to the internet and Google it, because the only things that come up, the first thing that comes up are the most extreme and craziest and wildest things that people can come up with about it, and it will literally scare you to death. Mm-hmm. And I unfortunately didn't have that advice from anybody, and I looked up about chordoma, and I, at that moment, seriously considered ending my life. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that kept me from doing that was Christopher. I hadn't waited my entire life for him to come along just to leave voluntarily.
Now, how old was Christopher when you were given this diagnosis?
He was 6, just a few months shy of turning 7.
He was quite a kid. Now, one of the things that you didn't try to hide a lot from him. You were as honest as you possibly could be, and you talk about how one of the most difficult things, and we'll go into a little bit more detail with this, is when you were going through your chemotherapy, how you couldn't have him in the room. He couldn't come in to visit you. because of the radiation that was there. I thought to myself when I was reading this how significant it was, the various points of information that you give, because you're very clear about this. They wanted to put you on Coumadin, and Coumadin is a rat poison.
Yeah.
You state that specifically, and that is a blood thinner, and it is extremely dangerous stuff to use because they have to do tests on you all the time. You can't be given too much, can't be given, you know, it's just amazing what they have to do with it. One day, I do not believe they're going to have to use it. They're going to have something else. But one of the processes that you created was an email group to give yourself a form of support. How did that work out for you?
Well, you know, it's one of the thoughts that I share in the book for people who are find themselves involved in a major illness. All your friends and relatives, they care about you, and they want to know what's going on. So they all call, or they stop by, or they write letters, or they send emails asking. And when something terrible is happening in your life, it's not a lot of fun to repeat it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that it was starting to make me feel a little depressed, you know, and I'd hang up the phone and I'd be bawling for a half hour. And I wanted to share with my loved ones and I wanted them to know, but I couldn't keep doing it that way. And so I did create a user group on my computer, and I called it Cancer. And I would just spell out everything that was happening with me at that period of time, the diagnoses and the treatments and the consequences of the treatments, and how I was doing. And I was, as you've read in the book, I was very candid about how things were going. But it was okay for me because just typing it wasn't the same as telling it to another person. It didn't have that same emotional toll on me, and
mm-hmm.
I only had to do it once. And everybody got to read it, they got to understand where I was at, and they got to send back their love and support. So it turned out to be a very good vehicle to communicate. It didn't drag me down, it actually helped lift me up.
Well, that's a very good point of information to be able to pass along to other people. And I think because of our technology today, that is really a wonderful blessing. And I know there are so many people that use their blogs and have their groups like you've had, maybe Facebook or something of that nature. And that's a very good thing to be able to utilize. Now, you talk about a period when you were in the hospital and you were getting ready to go into chemo. And this is something that I think is so poignant because you describe it so vividly, how when they first came to give you the treatment, they came in their, what I think it's called, hazmat, H-A-Z-M-A-T suits.
Yeah.
And it was like something out of 2001, the Space Odyssey. They came in these outfits. Tell us what you did.
Yeah, that was not a good experience. It's the only time in the whole process where I totally lost control. And first they said, you have to come, you know, to start. So that's a very difficult thing to do, to willingly go to the hospital, knowing that they're going to do this evil chemotherapy thing that you've read about and seen in movies. And they said, you have to be here at 6 or 7 in the morning. And so I went and I checked in, and then you waited all day, and you waited and you waited. When's it coming? It's coming soon. Finally, about 6 in the evening, they said, oh, great news. We've heard from the pharmacy. Your chemo drugs are coming, and we're going to start in just a little bit. And I'd been laughing and joking with the nurses all day long, you know, just trying to keep my spirits at ease, and that's my natural personality. And I was laying in the bed, and I heard something over at the door, and I turned and looked, and there were two spacemen. It was full hazmat suits. They looked like little blue spacemen, and they had the big head thing on with the globe on it so you could see their face, and the rubber gloves all the way up to their elbows, covering over the arms of their suit. And they've got this bag, and I'm like, what are you guys doing? And the one says, well, this is your chemo. And I said, well, I understand, but what's with the suits? And they said, well, we can't handle it just normally. We have to be in these hazmat suits. And I just lost it. I was not prepared for that. They didn't tell me that things were going to be different, that it was going to be this dramatic. And for some reason, it was just to see that this poison was so dangerous that they couldn't even carry it, and they were going to put that in my body, I just lost it. And I asked them to get the F out of the room. And they thought I was joking. And I'm, you know, like you said, at that time I was 6'3" and 302 pounds. And I made them understand in no uncertain terms that I was not joking. And they did get out of the room. And one of the nurses came back in and said, you know, what's the matter? What happened? And I said, you know, don't do that to anybody else. Please. You have no idea what it's like to be over here as the patient and not be forewarned. If you'd have told me that, you know, our safety requirements are that we have to wear these suits, and, you know, I don't want you to worry about it, I want you to be prepared for it, it would have been a whole different experience. But they scared the hell out of me.
And I think that is a very good message. People need to be informed. And I think of how many times people are trained, and unless they've been on the other side, they being the patient, they really won't always understand why people react the way that they do. And that can be very, very intimidating. And we have a lot of dedicated professionals, but when it comes to this scenario, it is. It's a very frightening thing. And when you realize that something like that is being put into your body, I think, again, you describe it very accurately in your book. It's like, wait a minute, you're going to do this to me, and you're saying you can't be exposed. This just doesn't make sense. So I really think what you have there is very good. Now, you went through some of the treatment. Christopher has his 7th birthday. You are going off on a camping trip with him, and then your hair is coming out. And you jokingly go and pull at your hair, and you find it comes out in your hand. That must have been quite an experience. Women will just weep when that happens many times. And, of course, they'll wear head coverings. What did you do to counteract that feeling?
Well, you know, it was, you know, on the off chance that the doctors were right, I was doing everything I could to build as many memories as possible with Christopher. And so when I had the ability, when I had the strength, we would do whatever we could do. And that was a trip with his cousins, who were the same age as Christopher, over to the Oregon coast. And we got my nephew and I got the kids to bed, and he said, you know, Dave, you don't look that sick. You know, I thought with chemotherapy, your hair is supposed to be falling out. And I took my baseball cap off and just grabbed a handful of hair, and I said, what, do you expect it to come out? Like, uh-oh. It did. A great big handful of hair just came right off my head. And you're right. A lot of women hold a very strong connection with beauty. And when their hair is falling out, it's very traumatic. A lot of them now, you know, Carrie does a lot of work with a group called Breast Friends, which is a support group for women who are going through breast cancer. And one of the things they help them with is they have wig parties. And the women get together and they shave their head in solidarity and they shop for wigs and they try to provide that moral support. For me, I went into the camp shower the next morning and started to wash what I thought was going to be my hair and ended up, you know, clogging the drain. And it was a pretty bizarre experience. But, you know, I still had my baseball cap.
Throughout this experience, through a good portion of it, Carrie was there. And you have such wonderful words about her, but you also have wonderful words about some very thoughtful people. And one of the gifts that you were given, these are my words, one of the gifts you were given was the awareness that there are a lot of very, very kind, thoughtful people in the world. You, like every cancer patient I've ever spoken with, have had a terrible time with food. All of the medications, the treatment, just wreak havoc with the body because it's also toxic. And you went to a restaurant called the Mount Fuji Rice Time, and you learned that miso soup, and I'm going to share this with people that I know, miso soup was something you could keep down. And you were able to have like a California roll. It was light, but it worked with your body. Tell us about these wonderful people. This is such a touching story,
yeah,
in my view.
You know, it's a wonderful restaurant in downtown Salem, and I had been to infrequently. I didn't go there a lot, but a friend of mine said, you know, let's go there. We can talk. If you can't eat, you know, that's okay, no big deal, but, you know, we can try something light. And I had never actually had the miso soup before. They serve it as a regular course, but it was just wasn't something that I partook of. But for some reason, it just sounded like a good idea, and I did it. I did eat it, and like you said, unusual for me at the time, I was able to keep it down. And so I went back a couple days later and tried it again, and went back, you know, a few days or a week later and tried it again. But this time I added the California roll, and, you know, one of the byproducts is neuropathy, which gives me a lack of control in my right hand, mm-hmm. where the nerves are damaged from the chemotherapy. And I couldn't hold the chopsticks. And the nice lady came over because she saw me struggling, and she said, she just leaned over and whispered in my ear, use your fingers. It's okay. And, you know, I was a little embarrassed because I didn't, you know, I'm a big guy. I don't want people knowing I can't do my job, you know, let alone pick up a bite to eat.
Right.
And, but I did eat it with my fingers, and I was able to keep it down. And the second or third time I was there, the owner asked, you know, what's going on? You know, I can tell that you're not well. And I explained. And they said, oh, the hospital food is so bad. She said, next time you're having chemotherapy, if you want or need some food, we will bring it to you. And I thanked them, because everybody that you meet when you're sick, they always want to help. Most people very rarely follow through on it. But I did decide one time when I was at the hospital, I couldn't keep the hospital food down. I thought, well, let's try the miso soup. And I called them, and they brought a big tub over straight away, refused to take any money, not even a tip for delivering it. And it was a godsend. And I called it my cancer medicine, because the main thing when you're going through the chemotherapy, when the medicine stops, you've got to build your strength back up, because it just literally just beats your body down.
Mm-hmm.
And that food and their unconditional love. I mean, just a total stranger. They didn't know me from Adam in a group of two. Were so loving and so caring, and it still means a lot to me today.
Oh, I just thought these are incredible people. So if any of you listening are in the area, check out Mount Fuji Rice Time. I'm happy to mention their name, because they're in Salem, and just this kind of thoughtfulness and kindness, there's so many people that are like this, and they just want to do. They really don't want any thanks for it. They just want to help. You say that everyone has the capacity to change his or her life. No one else is going to do it for you. And you follow a very simple and straightforward approach. Decide, then do. Very, very simple words. Three. Decide, then do. You are about living. You have a wonderful family. You have your lovely wife, Carrie. You have this support, and you're still active, but because of what you've gone through, you have to be mindful of what you choose to give your attention to.
Yeah, you know, on the decide, then do, I find so many people in life are paralyzed by procrastination. They're so worried about what might go wrong, or what component they might not have in order to accomplish a goal, and they never take those first steps to actually achieving the goal. And that's something I've done all my life. I don't know where the knowledge came from, but I've been blessed with an ability. When I have an idea, I just start taking the first steps on that journey. What's the first thing I need to do to accomplish that goal? And I go do it. And then what's the next thing and the next thing? And while everybody else is sitting around thinking about it, I'm out there actually doing it. And it has really made a big, big difference in my life. But you're right. I've had six major surgeries. The last one was just this past December. And I take about 32 pills a day. That's 2,400 milligrams of morphine to get through each day, because the pain, bone cancer, is one of the ugliest things you can deal with, and it's just horrible. And one of the fifth surgery they did, they actually went in and cut off the base of my spine, And so pain management is difficult, and I have to choose. Am I going to try to work today, or am I going to spend time with my wife today, or am I going to do a project with my sons today? Because I only get a few hours of productivity every day, and I mean like 2 to 4 hours each day, where mm-hmm. I can actually go out and be a normal human being. And the rest of the time, I'm incapacitated from a minor amount to curled up in the fetal position, bawling like a baby, because I just can't, the drugs just won't cover the pain that day.
Mm-hmm. David Koop, I will tell you, your book is powerful. And for any of those, for any of you listening that may know of someone that is going to be traveling down the path of having to deal with cancer, if you want to read a story about someone that has been able to survive what was not thought possible, this book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, the life story of a very lucky man, David A. Koop, is really worth reading and makes you aware of so many things, makes you aware of the scope of life in a way that you would never have considered. David, what's your website where people can go to?
It's somedaygroup.com. You know, someday I'm going to do this or someday I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Somedaygroup.com. And Donna, I've arranged for your listeners to get a big discount if they want to order the book. If they go to that website, it'll pop up with a screen for them and give them a discount of only $17.50 instead of the $25, the normal price.
Well, David, this is a phenomenal book. You are quite a man, and you've got a wonderful family. I think your story is well worth sharing with as many people as possible. Thank you for being a guest on my show today. I wish you nothing but the best. Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, David A. Koop, a man with a story that you really need to be aware of. His last name is spelled K-O-O-P. His website is somedaygroup.com, somedaygroup.com. Check it out. You'll be very glad you did. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. David, thank you for being my guest. We're coming to come back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I wanted to share with you, before I get into some other items, that in the back of David's book, there is something that is called my creed. And I was so impressed with this that I wanted to share it with you because the words are extremely powerful. I do not choose to be a common man. It is my right to be uncommon if I can. I seek opportunity, not security. I do not wish to be a kept citizen, humbled and dulled by having the state look after me. I want to take the calculated risk to dream and to build, to fail and to succeed. I refuse to barter incentive for a dole. I prefer the challenges of life to the guaranteed existence, the thrill of fulfillment to the stale calm of utopia. I will not trade freedom for beneficence, nor my dignity for a handout. I will never cower before any master nor bend any threat. It is my heritage to stand erect, proud, and unafraid, to think and act for myself, enjoy the benefits of my creations, and to face the world boldly and say, this I have done. All this is what it means to be an American. That creed was written by Dean Alfange. Very powerful words. I had to share that with you. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008. Well, I do want to... Oh, by the way, all I need from you is your first name or initial. If you're a first-time listener, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Again, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Scott Hammond. We're going to be discussing search and rescue. If ever you have watched anything on television where they're using these wonderful dogs, they've been used in so many various situations. Well, we're going to be talking about lessons of the lost, and that is what this is going to be about. Why Bother? Peter Legas is going to be with us on Friday, so I hope that you will be able to join us. Check out my website if you want more information on the upcoming guests that we have. Also, you can check right here on BBS with the information that is there. Father's Day is going to be coming up, and I come across these various stories. They cross my desk, and for those of you that are regular listeners, you know I read an incredible amount of material on a daily basis, and I really loved this story about a grandpa, so I thought I would share it with you. This is a story by Darcy Hossack. This is a woman that was recalling how her grandfather made such a difference in her life. And I think that in today's world, we are so mobile, many times families are disconnected. Grandparents are really important people. And to a little girl, a grandfather is a very, very special guy. And she said she was the 24th of 27 grandchildren. And he just absolutely loved his grandkids. She said, he taught me many things in very subtle ways. And she learned early on in life that love is often demonstrated in various actions and taking care of things in a particular way. And he always was so supportive of her whenever she was involved in projects. And when she was growing up, she had the chance to go out and be with Grandma and Grandpa out on a farm. And, of course, that was just perfect for her because she could do all kinds of things. She would sit, watch him when he was working in his workshop in the farm. And she said, I just had all of this wonderful freedom. I could roam about. I was told where I could go and where I couldn't go. But she said, there were all kinds of things for me to explore when I was a little girl. Everything from ducks to looking at mountains. And we talk about so many things. And she said, fortunately, we were only about 20 minutes away from my grandparents' home. And my mother would drive me there so that she and Dad could have some time to do some of the things they wanted to do. And one day, Darcy decided she was going to have a lemonade stand. And the area was beginning to develop, and houses were being built. When she decided she wanted to do the lemonade stand, she was just so excited about the whole thing because every once in a while a customer would come by. There wasn't a lot of heavy traffic on the road. And she was just thrilled anytime she got a little bit of money. Of course, you know she only probably called and charged about a nickel or so. And her mother was coming to get her, and she had been doing this lemonade stand, and she was so excited about it. But at the sight of her mom, she goes, uh-oh, I'm not going to be able to stay here. And she thought, I've got this lemonade stand. I can't leave. So she argued with her mother about she couldn't leave. She had to stay there with her lemonade stand. Her mother said, no, you're going to have to pack it up. You're going to have to do this another day because we have to leave. We have to go. Well, her granddad comes out. And she said she was just so upset over the whole thing. I mean, after all, she'd done all this work. She had built the stand all by herself. She had painted a sign. She had done so much work, and she'd had customers. To leave them and have to take everything down was just terrible. Well, her granddad said, you have to go with your mother. He had a newspaper with him, but he didn't tell her to take everything down. He just sat down in the chair that she had had set up. He said, now you go along with your mom, and you're going to be just fine. He said, it's a very nice day for lemonade. Now, as soon as you finish everything that has to be done, you come back, and we'll share some of it. So off she goes. When she came back, she said her granddad was still sitting there at the lemonade stand. In the little box that she had had there, where she had been collecting her change from her sales, she found that it was full. The neighborhood had come by, the people in the neighborhood, they were very supportive of her, and Granddad had continued to sell the lemonade for her. So when she came back at the end of the day, she and her granddad sat at that lemonade stand, and he looked at her and he said, well, I think it's about time to take it up, don't you think? She said, I think so. So together they took down the lemonade stand, packed everything up, took it back to the house in time for dinner. What was the lesson? She said the lesson was that her granddad loved her so much that he wasn't about to let what she had built be taken down. He wanted her to know that there were options, there were things that could be done, and she would have the support that she would need. There's probably a little bit more that maybe in your mind you could see as a benefit of this loving gesture by a grandfather that stayed with a lemonade stand that a little girl had built so that she would know that there was some very special things about life that she needed to be aware of. And he loved her so much, he supported her all the way. This is Donna Siebel. I know we're going to be taking a break in just a minute. So quickly, I want to give those of you that have not gotten your astrological forecast for summertime for this 2012 period. How about Aries and Taurus? We've done Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. So we've got Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, and Virgo left. So let's do Aries and Taurus. Quickly, for those under the sign of Aries this summer, you are going to have wonderful communication with people that you care for. And do you know what? There's going to be some kind of communication with a person that you have not been able to be in touch with for a long time. Well, they are going to be connecting with you, and this is a good time to build that communication link. When it comes to money, well, you're going to find August is really when the money flow is going to be increasing. You're going to get a financial surprise from an unexpected source, and you're going to discover that you are going to be able to manage your money in ways that you would not have thought possible. So money, though it's not going to be the priority in some respects, you're going to make it into something that's going to be more sustaining. Dreams, well, by golly, you're willing to take a chance. You're willing to take a risk, and you're going to be thoughtful about it. You're not going to just do it on a wing and a prayer. You're really going to be of the mindset that you're going to do whatever you need to do in homework and then implement the action. For those of you born under the sign of Taurus, well, we're going to have to come back after the break and share with you what your summer horoscope is going to be. And then I've got, well, a recipe or two and also a story about the unique and the unusual. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share with you a recipe here. Cowboy T-bones with whiskey butter. Yes, I know. You hear just about everything. But this one, I thought, amazing. Of course, we're in that time of the year where we are going to be barbecuing. So I have that recipe for you. But before I give you that recipe, so you might want to get a pad of paper and a pen, I wanted to share something with you about the unique, the unusual, and many times the unknown. There, I just got an email from someone. I wanted to share something with you about the Easter Island Moai. I received an email, and apparently there is a team of archaeologists that are on Easter Island, and I'm sure you've seen those statues. They are huge. They're just huge, and they weigh tons. Well, this archaeological group actually started digging down. What they have found, these massive statues, there is additional carving on the lower section, and I don't recall how many feet down they've gone so far. They have not actually gotten to the base of them yet, at least the photographs that I saw. But what they did find is that on these Easter Island statues, there is an area that shows a belly. It shows carving indicating the belly, and then there is all of this writing that is on this massive amount of stone. Now, I believe they have dug down and around one statue. I don't know that they've had multiples, because this is quite a job. So we're going to be finding out more about these Easter Island statues. But in 1722, on March 25th, Admiral Jacob Roggeveen, on Easter Sunday, noticed an island that was not in his charts. And the island was a rather eerie thing to come upon because it had these gigantic statues, which we're all familiar with. Of course, they found when they landed, they were stone statues, and they were carved from yellow-gray volcanic rock and had red rock topknots. They were called Moai by the native islanders, and he named it Easter Island because he landed on it on Easter Sunday. They didn't have a clue about the people that were there. They honestly, and even to this day, there is still a confusion and a perplexity because of these statues. What were they for? Why were they built? They wonder if they're ritualistic. They just don't know very much about it, but they have found that there's geomagnetic irregularities that they've recorded, and some people have thought that these statues might be a form of antennae, and They said one of the things that they have noticed is that there was a progression with the statues, but they all had the very same design. Heavy brows, sunken eye sockets, their chin would jut out, very long earlobes. And they did find that the eyes originally were designed from coral. Now, the carvings, the rock, came from a dormant volcanic crater of Rauraku, and they found inside this dormant crater 400 statues. One of them was 70 feet tall and weighed 270 tons. Now, they discovered their obsidian tools, and they don't know why the carvers or sculptors didn't finish the work. They haven't a clue. And they said there was a road leading from the crater where there were dozens of completed statues about every 50 yards or so, as far as they could see. Some of these statues were 10 miles away, and over 300 of these massive statues were transported and placed on bases, some of them up to 30 tons in weight, and a number of them were over 12 feet high. They cannot figure at this time, one, how were they transported? Two, how did they erect them? But there is a legend among the islanders that the statues walked to their platform. A form of levitation was used. We don't know any more than that. So be aware, with this new archaeological discovery that they have made, that there are these special carvings on these statues. And there is actually a language recorded. And I believe on Easter Island, they did find some written material, but they don't know how to interpret it. They still are in that learning curve with it. Mysteries, populations, civilizations that existed. What happened to them? Why did they disappear? Obsidian. This is something the Mayans used. Obsidian is stronger than steel and sharper than steel. Obsidian scalpels are very, very much treasured by surgeons because they don't leave behind bacteria and they have a very, very fine, sharp cutting edge. Amazing stuff. Cowboy T-Bones with whiskey butter. I don't know that I'm going to be able to share that recipe with you, but what I wanted to do, I'll have to save it for tomorrow because this is just, it's just absolutely awesome, perfect for barbecuing, and just a phenomenal flavor. If, even though you may not be someone that enjoys whiskey, it just is something that adds this incredible, incredible flavor. And I'm always into trying different things, new things, and let's see what we can do with it. This, I know we're out of time here. I'm so delighted you were able to join me. Don't forget, tomorrow we are going to be talking about search and rescue dogs. We're going to be talking about information on why they are so effective, but more than that, some very, very special stories that Scott Hammond is going to be sharing with us. And we've got so much more. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Today we heard the story about a man who is still alive after being given a death verdict about cancer. It's so important that we take control of our minds and our attitudes because there is your power. A lot of things can hit us in life. It makes a difference how we work with those circumstances. And I really encourage you, if you can, if you know of anybody that's suffering with cancer or has been given a diagnosis, get David Koop's book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing. I got it. It will make a difference, I think, in their lives and in their thinking. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be chatting with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.